Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, presenting the new major news articles of the Monday, July 6, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's check out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather mainly sunny, highs to 107 degrees Fahrenheit, winds northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tonight's weather, clear skies, lows near 80 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sunny along with few clouds, a stray shower or a thunderstorm is possible. Highs to 107 degrees Fahrenheit, winds northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Enough from the Arizona Daily Star front page. The first article is titled, Cases Set for Supreme Court Term. This article was written by Nate Raymond and Will Dunham of Reuters. Dateline Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court, fresh off a momentous term, already has a slate of important cases set up for its next term that begins in October on issues including guns, voting rights, LGBT rights, and a disputed detention policy used by President Donald Trump's administration for certain convicted immigrants. There are also cases due to be argued in the next term involving big corporations. These include a bid by ExxonMobil, XOM.N, and Suncor Energy, SU, to scuttle a climate-related lawsuit by officials in Boulder, Colorado, a dispute arising from an antitrust suit by Fortnite maker Epic Games against Apple APL.O, and a trademark case involving PepsiCo. The justices issued the final rulings of their last term, one dominated by cases involving Trump and his policies, last Monday and Tuesday, and more Trump-related cases being litigated in lower courts, promised to reach them during the next term. The court, which has a 6-3 conservative majority, has steadily moved American law rightward this decade. It has taken an expansive view of the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, and issued two more rulings last month widening gun rights. The gun case coming in the next term gives the justices an opportunity to strike down state restrictions on assault-style rifles such as AR-15s. They took up two appeals after lower courts upheld bans on such weapons in Connecticut and in Cook County, Illinois, which includes the city of Chicago. Gun rights groups have said Supreme Court precedents concerning the Second Amendment protect these weapons, which they describe as in common use. Officials in Connecticut and Cook County have called them weapons of war and the guns of choice for criminals and terrorists. The gun-reshaped gun regulation in 2022, when it held that modern restrictions must be consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation in order to comply with the Second Amendment. Since then, four U.S. appellate courts have upheld state-level bans on assault-style weapons. I think it's going to be hard for them to kind of sort out what the original understanding is for these kinds of new types of weapons, Vanderbilt University law professor Brian Fitzpatrick said. The court will have to grapple not just with whether the bans are consistent with historical U.S. regulation of firearms, but more fundamentally whether these weapons even constitute arms within the meaning of the Second Amendment, Fitzpatrick said. Some appeals courts have held that they are not, as these semi-automatics are ill-suited for self-defense and are predominantly used in military service. The court has an important voting rights case lined up for its next term. It will hear a Republican-led bid backed by the Trump administration to revive voter restrictions in Arizona that would stiffen proof of citizenship requirements for voter registrants and purge state voter rolls of alleged non-U.S. citizens. Responding to a lawsuit by Latino-focused voting advocacy group Mia Familia Vota, a lower court halted provisions of the Arizona's law, finding they violated a federal voting registration statute. Democrats have accused Republicans of pursuing voter suppression measures in a bid to lower voter turnout and disenfranchise specific groups of people who traditionally lean Democratic. Republicans have said their proposals are intended to protect election security. Much like with its mass deportation agenda, the Department of Justice is asking for something unprecedented. the power to remove voters from the rolls based solely on the suspicion that they are not citizens. Hector Sanchez Barba, the head of Mia Familia Voter, said in a statement, "The court has backed Trump in a series of cases involving his crackdown on immigration, though it ruled against his attempt to restrict birthright citizenship. The justices in the coming term will hear his administration's appeal in a case involving the legality of subjecting certain convicted immigrants with pending deportation proceedings to lengthy detention without bond hearings that would allow them to seek release on bail. A lower court ruled that the constitutional right to due process bars unreasonably prolonged detention without a hearing for non-citizens who face deportation after being convicted of certain crimes." Another LGBT-related case from Colorado comes before the court after justices in March rejected the state laws that banned psychotherapists from using conversion talk therapy intended to change an LGBT minor's sexual orientation or gender identity on free speech grounds. The justices will hear the bid by the Archdiocese of Denver and other Catholic entities for exemption from a Colorado preschool funding program's non-discrimination requirement in the court's latest clash between religious rights and LGBT protections. A lower court found that Colorado's program did not violate the constitutional religious right of the Catholic plaintiffs. The next front page article is titled, UA Launches Semiconductor Talent Hub in Taiwan. This article was written by Purana Sanapanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. The University of Arizona is launching a talent and innovation hub in Tucson and Taiwan to offer academic courses and internship opportunities related to semiconductor engineering. The hub, a UA partnership with National Yangming Chiu Tung University, will be launched in October and will welcome its first students in spring 2027. The UA is working with the Pima County Office of Economic Development, which will provide a physical space for the hub in Tucson, and with the Arizona Commerce Authority in this initiative. On the Taiwan end, the hub will be based at NYCU's campus in Hsinchu, a city in northwestern Taiwan. The hub will be jointly overseen by representatives of UA, NYCU, and Pima County Office of Economic Development and the Arizona Commerce Authority. This is for us to jointly develop training and research platforms that will greatly benefit the semiconductor ecosystem that is already very well established in Taiwan and emerging in the state of Arizona, where for all practical purposes, Arizona has become ground zero for semiconductor manufacturing, said Krishna Mahiladharan, director of UA Center of Semiconductor Manufacturing. As the name suggests, talent, which is students, and innovation, which is research, and that's where our focus is, he said in an interview with the Arizona Daily Star. The hub is meant to serve as an interface between industry and academia, Mahiladharan said. He said they're trying to leverage the UA's existing semiconductor and photonics portfolio in courses and training and develop specifically designed learning platforms and pathways which will help students be ready and hit the ground running as they enter the workforce. UA students interested in participating in the hub will not need to pay anything in addition to their regular tuition and university fees, and will only need to apply through an online portal using their UA email accounts. Applicants will be expected to maintain a 3.0 grade point average to be eligible. Students in STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics disciplines, including the UA's Colleges of Engineering, Science, and Optical Sciences, will be the initial focus of the hub. Ultimately, our vision is this would evolve into a global hub that brings in like-minded universities who are very keen on student success, who are very keen on students getting hands-on experience as they go through their learning, said Mahiladharan. The UA has strong relationship with India, Netherlands, Germany, Ireland, Vietnam, he said, and so what we're trying to do is ultimately create this network of universities and create global training modalities. As part of the Taiwan Hub, in addition to taking courses from the UA and NYCU, participating students from both universities will have internship opportunities based on industry partners' needs, said UA spokesperson Mitch Zack. Heath Vescovi, economic developer Development Director for Pima County, said the county's role with the hub is to help build it from ground up and be a supportive partner by providing the physical space, which can eventually include the UA Center for Innovation, a startup ecosystem, and more. Vescovi said the county has been working with Taiwan for the last 2 years. The county has various building assets and officials are figuring out which potential sites make the most sense for the hub. They're also still figuring out the financial structure between the UA and the county, he said. County officials see the hub as an important opportunity due to the growth of the semiconductor industry and the quality of jobs and workforce available, and also because of university's specialties, Vescovi said. Mora Litharan, who is also a UA professor in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering, noted that over the years, Arizona has had a very strong presence of Intel, a U.S. semiconductor manufacturing company in Chandler. He also said the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, in Phoenix, is growing exponentially since coming to Arizona in 2020. The semiconductor ecosystem is vast. Just to make a chip, you need 100 different suppliers, Morad Lehrerdan said. So everyone's moving into Arizona, and the University of Arizona being the land-grant university, it's almost in our constitution to ensure that all our state stakeholders' needs are met, he said. And what we felt was, with TSMC moving in and the entire ecosystem getting revitalized, with a push towards revitalizing manufacturing within the U.S., the U of A wanted to make sure that we're producing students who can hit the ground running, who are well-trained, who understand what it takes to work in this evolving semiconductor landscape, and that's why we partnered with NYCU. NYCU is considered one of the leading technological and research universities in Taiwan, ranking consistently between second and fourth place nationally, as well as in the top 50 universities in Asia, according to the QS World University Rankings in 2026. It also ranks among the top 200 in the world. The university's two main campuses are in Hsinchu and Taipei, which are also the hubs of Taiwan's semiconductor industry, with the two cities dividing the industry's operations into physical manufacturing and corporate and design operations. Hsinchu is often called the Silicon Valley of the East, being the heart of the global semiconductor supply chain. Taipei is the financial, administrative, and strategic center that connects Taiwan's expertise to the rest of the world. As part of the hub, UA students will be able to take courses in Tucson as well as in Taiwan, as will the Taiwanese students. Morad Litharan said the UA has had a very strong portfolio in semiconductor manufacturing dating back 50 years, including the Center for Semiconductor Manufacturing, which conducts environmentally sustainable microelectronics research and workforce development. The partnership with NYCU comes nearly a year after the UA eliminated its four microcampuses in China after a report by the Republican majority of the U.S. House Select on the Chinese Communist Party criticized U.S. universities' partnerships in China. In letters and interviews, UA students in China expressed dismay at the closures. Vescovi, who's also an adjunct faculty member at the UA Schools of Government and Public Policy, said Pima County had a pre-existing partnership with Taiwan and pays attention to all levels of politics, federal, state, and local. He said while this hub isn't being looked at as a replacement for the micro-campuses in China, the economic development it brings in job creation and teaching opportunities is a unique opportunity. When we talk about politics at the federal level and the global level, that's where we're working with Arizona Commerce Authority comes into play very significantly, said Vescovi, because they effectively understand more clearly the way the state can interact with those global partners based off their interpretation of federal level policy and what global and international relations look like. Along with getting technical immersion into the semiconductor industry, hub students will also experience cultural immersion through courses such as Mandarin for Industry, Morad Litharan said. What we're trying to do is to ensure that they get experience working with students in Taiwan where they get used to different ways of thinking and different ways of approaching a problem. The next front page article is titled, Trump Jr. Poised to Make Millions Off Firearm Proposal. This article was written by Dan Rosenzweig Ziff of Reuters. Dateline Washington, Donald Trump Jr. helped take an online retailer known as the Amazon of Guns public last year. Now Grab a Gun, where the U.S. president's son is a shareholder and board member, could reap a windfall from a proposed rule change at Trump's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives that would make it easier to ship guns directly to people's homes. If finalized, the rule would be among the most consequential changes to the U.S. gun policy in two decades, potentially driving huge growth in online gun sales, according to 10 industry officials, store owners, and gun controls advocates interviewed by Reuters. The proposal would allow licensed dealers to ship firearms directly to in-state residents who undergo an online identity verification and background check, along with a 7-day waiting period after notifying local law enforcement. Currently, online buyers must pick up firearms at physical stores and undergo in-person background checks unless they have a permit. Some gun shop owners, industry officials, and gun control advocates argue the direct shipping of firearms poses significant public safety and security risks and threatens the viability of small brick-and-mortar gun shops. The change could benefit Trump Jr., whose more than 300,000 shares in Grab a Gun are worth more than $700,000, down from more than $5 million last year. A spokesperson for Trump Jr., Andrew Sarabian, said in a statement, the president's son had no role in the ATF proposal. Don is a lifelong businessman and local advocate of our Second Amendment rights, he said. He does not interface with the federal government as part of his role with any company that he invests in or advises and had zero involvement in this particular decision. Grab a Gun CEO Mark Nemati told Reuters that neither he nor Trump Jr. knew this proposal was coming. He said in an interview that the company is still analyzing the potential impact of the rule change on its $100 million in revenue. The CEO was bullish, however, in a May news release. We believe Grab a Gun is uniquely positioned to capitalize on this potential opportunity. The ATF project said half of all gun buyers, nearly 3.3 million people a year, would eventually use the home delivery method. Some industry leaders told Reuters they expect the actual numbers to be far higher because of the convenience of online shopping. Online ordering for in-store pickup currently represents a smaller but still substantial portion of U.S. gun sales, industry experts say. ATF Chief Counsel Robert Leidas said in an interview that he oversaw a team effort at the agency to craft the proposed rule. He said it aimed to align the gun industry with the rest of the modern economy. The agency estimates the change would save consumers $103.7 million annually in travel and processing time. Leidas said he was unaware of Trump Jr.'s connection to Grab a Gun until asked by Reuters, and that the president's son had no influence on the proposed rule. Leidas declined to say whether the White House had a role in the proposal. The White House said it had no record or knowledge of any interaction with the president's son on any of these topics. The rule is one of 34 deregulatory measures proposed by the ATF this spring in response to a February 2025 presidential executive order to expand gun access. Marianne Mitchum, a senior firearms industry advisor at Everytown for Gun Safety, worked at ATF for more than 20 years, including about four as the industry liaison. She said the industry never asked for a similar policy in her interactions, and that physical gun shops historically played a key role in vetting owners. ATF always says the gun store is the first line of defense in gun safety, said Mitchum, who is against the proposed rule, but now they're flipping it. Founded in 2010, Grab a Gun is one of the nation's leading online first gun retailers, though some competitors with the physical operations also provide online ordering. Grab a Gun would be poised for substantial growth under the new ATF rule, but competitors, including major outdoor stores and other retailers, could also take advantage of the regulations, according to industry analysts former ATF officials, and gun shop owners. Trump Jr. emerged as the face of GrabAGun last year when it went public through a special purpose acquisition company merger that netted the company $119 million. That SPAC was brought by 1789 Capital, with Trump Jr. as a partner. Shares of the company, which trades under the ticker PEW, have dropped 85% over the past year. Reuters could not establish the factors driving the stock's falling price. Trump Jr. argued that at the time that the online gun sales were safe because they were sending guns to gun shops for customer pickup rather than directly to homes, as a new rule would allow. He also made TV appearances to argue that young people and women who may not otherwise want to visit a gun store would flock to the company's more accessible website. "People buy everything online," Trump Jr. told Fox Business last summer. The title of our next front page article is "Drug Cartels Adapt to U.S. Boat Strikes." This article was written by Carson Oyer of the Cronkite News Service, Dateline Washington. Stopping drug trafficking has been a key priority for President Donald Trump, but his policies redirecting the focus from routine counter-narcotics operations shows of military force have made that goal harder to achieve, according to veterans of the U.S. War on Drugs and other experts on drug smuggling. If anything, the experts say strikes that put barely a dent in the flow of narcotics have been a gift to the cartels by impeding international cooperation to combat drug trafficking. As they always do in the perennial game of whack-a-mole, cartels adapted to disruptions in the supply chain. Since September, the U.S. military has conducted 66 strikes in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean against vessels officials say were transporting narcotics, killing 215 people. But drug trafficking networks are far more complex than a few dozen boats. Cocaine prices have stayed roughly the same since the first strike, at $600 to $100 per gram. According to addiction scientists, fentanyl prices are also stable, nor do police and federal authorities report shortages on the street, all of which indicates that supply and demand remained in equilibrium. It's impossible to know the quantity of drugs smuggled into the U.S., though both proponents and critics of the boat strikes cite customs and border protection drug seizures as a good proxy. That data shows fentanyl interdiction on track to drop 6.3% in the fiscal year ending September 30th, and cocaine interdiction on pace to drop by 5.4%. These dips are big enough for Trump and his allies to claim success and far too modest for critics to give him credit for solving the chronic problem. Those sporadic, high-profile, theatrical strikes are not really going to address that broader issue, said Lee Schlenker, a research associate at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, adding there's no direct evidence that boat strikes reduce the flow of narcotics into the U.S. Nor has the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January, as evidenced in part by the fact that the boat strikes continue even as Maduro awaits trial in New York. The first such strike was on September 2nd, 2025, when the U.S. Southern Command sank a boat in international waters off Venezuela, killing 11 people. Trump asserted that the boat was transporting narcotics to the U.S. and that those killed were members of a group he described as Tren de Aragua Narcoterrorists. TDA is a designated foreign terrorist organization operating under the control of Nicolas Maduro, responsible for mass murder, drug trafficking, sex trafficking, and acts of violence and terror across the United States and Western Hemisphere, he said on Truth Social. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth authorized a follow-on strike against a disabled vessel, killing two survivors clinging to the boat. Reports of the double-tap strikes provoked an uproar and allegations of unlawful military action. Hegseth ousted the four-star head of Southcom, Admiral Elvin Halsey, after he raised concerns about the strike's legality. Tren de Aragua is a Venezuelan transnational criminal organization that the Trump administration designated as a terrorist group in February 2025. Elements do traffic narcotics, but it is not a drug cartel in the usual sense, and no large cocaine shipments have been linked to it. Within a week of the Double Tap strike, Trump announced that the military had conducted another strike on an alleged drug boat in international waters off Venezuela, killing three people. The most recent known strike was on June 21st in the Eastern Pacific, killing two and leaving six survivors at large in the ocean. Derek Maltz, a 28-year-old veteran of the Drug Enforcement Administration, who served as acting DEA administrator in the first 4 months of Trump's second term, said, "The strikes show the world that the U.S. treats drug traffickers like other terrorist groups. This is a big deterrent," he said. Still, he said, these bad guys are very knowledgeable on how they strategically move their products around the world. The Defense Department has not provided evidence of drugs aboard any of the boats. There is no indication that any drugs on most boats sunk so far in the Caribbean are destined for the U.S. instead, the most likely headed to Europe, Schlenker said. Drugs are smuggled throughout the Western Hemisphere by plane, rail, container ship, and truck, in addition to the go-fast boats and semi-submersible vessels hit in the strikes. Drug cartels have increased their reliance on air transport and shipping containers since the strikes began, according to a March report on Operation Southern Spear from the Department of Defense Inspector General. At a House Armed Services Committee hearing that month, Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense Joseph Humeyer testified that drug boat traffic has dropped 20% in the Caribbean and 25% in the Eastern Pacific since the first strike. Traditional interdiction efforts in the Caribbean involved the U.S. Coast Guard seizing narcotics and arresting traffickers. Airstrikes that kill the smugglers don't leave that sort of intelligence behind, Schlenker pointed out. Southcom has not publicly released metrics of Operation Southern Spear's effectiveness. Marine General Francis Donovan, who took over Southcom in February, told the Senate Armed Services Committee in March that the strikes have led traffickers to change their patterns. He acknowledged that the boat strikes aren't the answer, though, and said the military is moving towards a counter-cartel campaign targeting the full drug transit network. At a June 2nd Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, pressed Secretary of State Marco Rubio to explain the criteria for ordering a strike against a particular boat. Rubio said intelligence must show true links to criminal activity. But he conceded that evidence that drugs are aboard is not one of the three criteria, all of which remains classified. "How odd is it that the presence of narcotics on the boat is not one of the targeting criteria," Kaine said. Jonathan Calkins, a professor of public policy at Carnegie Mellon University, said that destroying boats or seized drugs make for good optics, but are just a cost of doing business for traffickers. "The boat strikes can certainly inconvenience cartels," he said, "while also failing to deliver a significant blow to the trafficking network. There are many other ways of moving the drugs from point A to point B," he said. "Much of the drug street price stems from the risks and costs of transportation. Early in the journey, the product is relatively cheap, and the cartels can absorb losses fairly easily. Often the more valuable contribution is destroying the throughput capacity of the network," Calkins said. "Unless authorities can make a business profitable, the revenue continues to fuel the drug trade," he said. "So the key metric is whether a network remains intact after a seizure by authorities. If so," he said, "the network will continue to supply drugs." Seizures also can't eliminate drugs from the market if the cartels can scale up production. South American cocaine production grew fourfold from 2014 to 2024, according to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Maduro's capture is another element of Trump's drug strategy that experts view as more theatrical than effective. Enrique Desmond Arias, a professor of Western Hemisphere Affairs at Baruch College, said the institutional corruption that allowed drug trafficking to thrive in Venezuela persists. "Nothing in what's happened in Venezuela suggests to me a more profound change," Arias said. Annette Eidler, a professor of global security at the University of Oxford, wrote in January that Maduro's capture could even cause disorder that would benefit organized crime. Decades of evidence show that militarized drug policies do not reduce supply or demand. They fragment violence and expand illicit networks, she wrote. Another knock on Operation Southern Spear is that it almost exclusively addresses the flow of cocaine while ignoring fentanyl. That's the primary cause of overdose deaths in the U.S., the Government Accountability Office reported on the same day as the first boat strike. Synthetic opioids, primarily fentanyl, accounted for 69% of overdose deaths in 2023, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Cocaine was responsible for 28%. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. We'll now turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles. The title of the first article is Arizona Medical Changes Loom. This article was written by Stephanie Innes of the Arizona Republic. Not a day goes by without staff at the Valley del Sol Health Clinic in Phoenix strategizing about the looming date of January 1, 2027 and what it will mean for their low-income patients' health coverage. We will absolutely see a spike in uninsured people. My biggest concern is that people who are eligible will be cut because of the administrative burden, said Mike Renaud, the CEO of Via del Sol, a federally qualified community health center that sees roughly 15,000 patients per year, half of whom are covered by Medicaid, which in Arizona is called the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or AHCCCS, pronounced access. Medicaid is the largest health insurance program for low-income people in the United States. It is the largest payer of mental health services in the U.S. January 1, 2027, 5 months away, is the deadline for Medicaid programs in 43 states across the country, including Arizona, to implement major policy changes that include work requirements and twice-yearly renewals, up to once yearly for certain enrollees. In Arizona, the new rules will mark the largest operational change in the history of the AHCCCS program, said Megan Kramer, health policy advisor to Governor Katie Hobbs. This is the fastest we've ever had to do something that is operationally complex. And this is the most operationally complex thing they've ever had to do, Kramer said. We're straining existing systems that are already old and overburdened on the IT side. And we will need much, much more work on the eligibility side than we have now. The changes are the result of H.R. 1, the Budget Reconciliation Bill, also known as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which President Donald Trump signed into law on July 4, 2025. The law significantly changes both eligibility and financing of Medicaid, which is a government health insurance program primarily for low-income people that has been in place since 1965. Arizona has had a Medicaid program since 1982. Having only 18 months to prepare for H.R. 1 is an extremely heavy technological lift for states, including Arizona. Arizona's aggressive implementation of H.R. 1 changes to SNAP, SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, once known as food stamps, resulted in the highest rate of loss of SNAP recipients in the country, with about 450,000 dropping from the program from February 2025 to mid-2026. Recipients and would-be recipients have told the Arizona Republic SNAP benefits are harder to get than ever, with long hold times on the phone and at satellite offices, a dysfunctional website, and fewer DES employees to help them. The new state budget that was recently signed includes a little more than $10 million that will go to technology and to employees who will be handling the increased workload, Kramer said. Hopefully, state officials have learned from the experience with SNAP and don't make the same mistake again, said Will Humble, executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. The computer system needs to improve and the staff needs to be trained, Humble said. I'm convinced the majority of people who lose coverage will lose it because of administrative reasons. Further complicating the implementation is that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently released a 387-page interim final rule with strict new guidelines about Medicaid work requirements. The new guidelines, for example, do not automatically exempt people with cancer and end-stage renal disease, among other conditions, from the work requirements. It is written in a way that makes it clear that this is going to be a much more challenging task than any state anticipated, Kramer said of the guidelines. States are really struggling with what the new guideline system's guidance means. The new guidance is going to be much more burdensome in the member, the applicant, and the Medicaid agency long term. 24 attorneys general, including Arizona Attorney General Chris Mayes, and two governors on June 30 sued the federal government over the document, arguing that it illegally narrows congressional protections of medically frail people enrolled in the program. Access as of June 1st provided health insurance to approximately 1.8 million Arizonans, which works out to 1 in 4 state residents. About 1 in 4 of those access enrollees, or 400,000 to 500,000 people, are expected to be part of the adult expansion population affected by the work requirements and twice annual renewals. At Valley del Sol, Reynolds said clinicians and other staff are already educating patients and clearing up misinformation. We want to make sure they understand this is not a Medicaid cut, it is increased barriers to maintaining coverage. Here are 7 things to know about the coming changes to Medicaid in Arizona. Access will be providing communications to impacted enrollees by September 1st. Most enrollees probably don't know whether they are part of the affected adult expansion population, and that's part of the outreach. People covered by Access can expect to see communications via mail, text, and email. The goal will be to make sure we are providing reliable information to everybody to reassure folks that they should continue to fill out paperwork when they are prompted by their health plan or by Access, Kramer said. For now, there's nothing Arizonans need to do, Access officials say, except to keep their contact information current on Health eArizona Plus. Respond if Access is your health plan or your health plan reaches out to you, and watch for official updates from Access, not third parties. Annual Access renewals, also known as redeterminations, happen on a rolling basis, and that's how twice annual renewals and work requirements will be handled too. If they were determined last January 1st, they will get redetermined again the next January 1st. And then beginning that year, they're getting redetermined every 6 months, she said. Enrollees who are part of the adult expansion population will need to prove they are working at least 80 hours per month or doing other qualified activity like job training or education to avoid losing coverage. State officials are able to verify through pay stubs that some people are already meeting the work requirements, but not for everyone. At some point, self-attestation, simply saying you are volunteering or in school, won't be enough. What we know is the rules are more aggressive beginning in the year 2028, and there will be some allowance for self-attestation in the first year, Kramer said. But after the first year, beginning January 1, 2028, self-attestations are only permitted once in a continuous eligibility cycle. So that would place an enormous burden on Access and DES, the Department of Economic Security, which plays a large role in Medicaid eligibility determinations. Several categories of Arizona's Medicaid expansion populations will be exempt from the work requirements, but not limited to pregnant and postpartum women, people who are disabled or medically frail, parents or caretakers of children under 14, caregivers of someone with a disability, American Indians and Alaska Natives, and those already meeting similar requirements under SNAP. Kramer said that state officials are working to determine on their end who is exempt from requirements in order to lessen the burden on enrollees. Arizona will be offering short-term hardship exemptions to the work requirements for people who have recently been hospitalized, who need to travel outside of their community for medical care, who live in a county with high unemployment rates, or who live in a community where national emergency or disaster has recently been declared. Access spokesperson Johnny Cordova wrote in an email. Access relies primarily on two major systems to administer eligibility and benefits, and both are old. PMMIS, the agency's core Medicaid administration system, was originally implemented in 1991 and is currently undergoing modernization with the outdated platform scheduled to go live on October 2027, Cordova wrote. HEA Plus, Arizona's eligibility system, was implemented in 2013. While both systems have undergone significant upgrades and enhancements over time to support changing federal and state requirements, the PMMIS Modernization Program project, rather, will not be complete before the federal requirements in H.R. 1 take effect, Cordova wrote. Hospitals, community health centers, and health plans already connect people to benefits, including access. One of the key goals of those entities statewide is to ensure enrollment specialists are all trained on how to interact with the technology that's going to be used to implement H.R. 1, Kramer said. All those entities have an interest in keeping people insured. Without health insurance, people tend to wait until their health problems reach a critical point before seeking care, which can cause personal medical debt, bad debt for hospitals, and increase health costs across the board. The Health System Alliance of Arizona, which includes major Arizona health systems such as Banner Health and Honor Health, is extremely concerned about eligible individuals losing Medicaid coverage due to the increase in renewals and work requirements passed in H.R. 1, Brittany Kaufman, Alliance CEO, wrote in an email. Our systems are assessing all options to ensure Medicaid members are aware of these changes. The next article is titled, EPA Proposes a New Coal Ash Disposal Rules. This article was written by Alyssa D. Bicente of the Arizona Republic. The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing changes to federal coal waste disposal regulations, a move that nearly 200 public interest groups say would weaken protections against toxic coal ash and put water sources at risk. For decades, electric utilities disposed of coal ash, the waste left behind after burning coal for electricity, in unlined ponds and landfills. Arizona has 12 coal ash disposal sites. The environmental law nonprofit Earth Justice reported in 2023. Arizona utilities operated 10 federally regulated coal ash landfills at 5 power plants, the group said, all of which have groundwater contamination. One site has pollutant levels more than 20 times the federal limit. Although many coal-fired power plants have closed in recent years, including the Navajo Generating Station in northern Arizona, the Trump administration has pushed for a revival of coal, loosening regulations and insisting that utilities keep coal power plants operating. The proposed regulatory changes would allow some facilities to certify the closure of older coal ash ponds if the coal ash was removed before November 8, 2024, and under regulatory oversight. Their proposal would also relax or eliminate several eligibility requirements for certain legacy coal ash ponds seeking to delay compliance with federal closure standards while site-specific decisions are made. In addition, the EPA is proposing to exempt from federal regulation certain structures used primarily to remove water from coal ash before it is disposed of elsewhere. The agency is also seeking to eliminate current requirements for coal combustion residual management units while requesting public comment on possible alternative regulatory approaches. The proposed rule will severely harm water resources and the health of communities across the nation, according to a letter signed by 196 public interest groups who oppose the proposal. We urge EPA to immediately withdraw this dangerous and illegal proposal and instead aggressively enforce the federal coal ash rules that are currently protecting the health and environment of Americans. Failure to do so will result in widespread harm from toxic waste, inflicted with full knowledge of the consequences by your EPA. Coal ash, also known as coal combustion residuals, is a byproduct of burning coals at power plants. It contains toxic metals such as mercury, cadmium, and arsenic. If not properly managed, these contaminants can pollute rivers, groundwater, drinking water supplies, and the air. In the opposition letter, the group said EPA and industry data have confirmed repeatedly that the hazardous constituents in coal ash also include boron, chromium, cobalt, lead, lithium, molybdenum, and radium, and pose serious harm to human health and the environment when they are released into air, water, and soil. The opponents also said that EPA's broad removal of health and environmental protection in the proposed rules will cause irreparable harm. Leaking coal ash dumps are releasing chemicals linked to cancer, heart and thyroid disease, reproductive failure, and neurological harm. EPA's current coal ash regulations are the product of decades of research by EPA, the Centers for Disease, Coal, and Prevention, and independent scientists. The rules are informed by robust industry data, citizen input, and evidence at scores of sites contaminated by mismanagement of toxic ash, the letter said. EPA acknowledges that releases of toxic chemicals from coal ash have occurred at most coal plants, resulting in groundwater exceeding federal safe standards at most every plant. Coal-fired power plants generate millions of tons of coal ash each year, according to the American Coal Ash Association. U.S. power plants produced about 63.6 million tons of coal combustion residuals in 2024. Over the years, coal plants have generated an estimated 5 billion tons of coal ash, much of it stored in landfills and surface impoundments, often near lakes and rivers. Environmental advocates warn that these storage sites can leak or fail, contaminating soil, groundwater, and nearby waterways and posing risks to surrounding communities. The Attorney General of Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Illinois, Delaware, Maryland, Minnesota, and Vermont have also submitted comments opposing the EPA's proposed changes to federal coal ash regulations. The states opposed the proposal, arguing it would weaken protections adopted in the EPA's 2024 coal ash rule. They say the changes would roll back regulations for older coal ash ponds and other coal ash disposal sites while shifting more responsibility to states to address environmental risks and cleanup. Many of these dangerous proposed rollbacks are characterized as offering additional flexibility to permitting authorities, who are often state authorities, wrote the Attorney General letter. The officials urged EPA to retain strong national baseline standards that protect human health and the environment. Rather than improving the program, more flexibility threatens to leave the environmental risk from massive quantities of CCR ignored under the federal regulations, leaving states with the administrative burden of cleaning up the mess. The states also argued that if the EPA moves forward without addressing these concerns, the proposal would violate the Administrative Procedure Act and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. They urged the agencies to keep current coal ash regulations adopted under the 2024 rule. While proposed changes to federal coal ash regulations have drawn concern from states and environmental organizations, the Navajo Station is also weighing Navajo Transitional Energy Company's proposal to expand the Navajo mine into the Burnham, New Mexico community. In January, the Arizona Republic reported that community members and Navajo-led environmental organizations had voiced opposition to the expansion. This proposed expansion of the Navajo mine by the NTEC could keep the operation running for 110 years, even though the only coal-fired power plant that supplies Four Corners Power Plant is set to close in 2031. For the most part, Navajo leaders support the endeavor, including President Bu Nguyen and the Navajo Nation's Council Resource and Development Committee. The majority of the six-member committee is seeking re-election. Recently, the committee met with NTEC's board of directors to receive $5.5 million dividend for the Navajo Nation. The dividend generated from NTEC's 2025 performance year is the largest distribution ever provided by the Navajo enterprise, an increase from the $3.15 million distribution received in September 2025. I want you to know that as mine workers, you represent NTEC and the mine every day, Delegate Ricky Nez says. In addition to the dividends provided to the Navajo Nation, NTEC supports scholarships, community programs, veterans, elders, and provides coal assistance to Navajo and Hopi families. According to NTEC, the Navajo mine provides high-paying jobs for more than 600 employees, 86% of whom are Navajo. The operation also contributes more than $100 million annually to the Navajo Nation through taxes, royalties, and wages, supporting approximately 35% of the Navajo National Nation General Fund. While Navajo Nation leaders have largely emphasized coal mining's role in supporting jobs and generating revenue for the tribe's general funds, some community members say the long-term environmental and health impact experienced by nearby residents are usually ignored. Carletta Chief, an associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Environmental Science at the University of Arizona, presented preliminary findings to the Navajo Nation Resource and Development Committee on behalf of Renee Tsingti, PhD, also of the UA. Findings were based on listening sessions conducted between November 2025 and January 2026 to examine how coal mining has affected the health, well-being, and daily lives of Navajo residents on Black Mesa, where previously once operated the Kayenta and Black Mesa strip mines. The listening sessions included 42 participants from the Kayenta and Forest Lake chapters, the majority of whom were women. Chief said discussions show that coal mining has had wide-ranging effects on the well-being of Black Mesa residents, including impact on health, wildlife, the environment, traditional ways of life, livelihood, and lasting community hardships. The first thing is coal mining impacts participants recall the beauty of the land before mining began, Chief said. It was beautiful at one time. We had trees and greenery. Once the land got dug into, all that changed, Chief said. Many participants described a sense of broken promises made to their communities during their years of coal mining. The mine has closed down and they pretty much left us with nothing, one participant said. It kind of makes me feel sad, angry. That what was promised never came to fruition, and a lot of people are now gone, and none of these promises have been fulfilled. Chief said participants also discussed the health impacts of coal mining, including emotional stress and trauma. Through the listening sessions, many shared stories of family members and neighbors becoming ill from black lung disease. Some said elders never fully understood the illness they were facing. Participants also described environmental changes they have witnessed over the years. She noted the participant explained how there was less water available as well as contamination of their water source that killed countless sheep and livestock. But these areas have natural springs. Very rarely do they flow, but when you go to the area now, it's dry now. Chief said, one participant said, vegetation that used to grow near those springs are no longer there. The fourth theme focused on impact on traditional practices. Participants said coal mining activities disrupted cultural practices, sacred areas, and ceremonial sites. Some also suggested the Navajo Nation could support the community by helping develop a cultural center or museum to preserve shared local history and traditions. To really say this is what we had before Peabody destroyed all of this. A participant said, even if you say no, they demolish those things, Chief said. They don't want our culture, one participant said. We are kind of the last generation complaining about what Peabody has done to us. They are just waiting, even the Navajo tribe. They are just waiting for us to die off. The next article is titled, No Cases of Cyclospora Reported in Arizona. This article was written by USA Today Network. Federal health officials are reporting cases of a parasite that can cause prolonged diarrhea in 17 states during the peak summer season for cyclosporiasis. Arizona has not reported any cases in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention latest update, though nearby Colorado and Texas are among the states with infections. From May 1st through June 16th, the CDC recorded 145 likely domestically acquired cases of cyclosporiasis. 20 people were hospitalized and no deaths were reported. Federal officials said the cases do not appear tied to one outbreak. The CDC said that it is tracking several clusters of infections and investigating possible sources. The CDC currently lists also include Alaska, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Louisiana, Massachusetts, New Mexico, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Cyclosporiasis is caused by Cyclospora synthesis, a microscopic parasite people can pick up by eating or drinking something contaminated, according to the CDC. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the July 6, 2026 edition of the Arizona Daily Star. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.